body functions at its best when. And this is Granger Westberg, and now I've set it for the tape. We didn't have a chance to have much feedback at all last time, as you know, and I would like to be sure that we got time tonight. I didn't have enough of those Xerox copies for all of you last time, and I tried to get some more, and Uncle Normie said he would give me some more, and I got an envelope from him today, but there was only one in there. So that apparently wasn't the right one I was supposed to get. So, any leftover comments? Always a little hard to pick up that far afterward, but I'll give you a chance later to do so.
I wanted to ask you.
Yes.
Did the pattern that you draw, I know it reflects the spiritual and the emotional. You also argue that it reflects the physical progression downward and then back upward.
Yeah, I think that it's very difficult to separate the emotional or mental from the physical. And the physical and the mental follow so much the same pattern. However, in order to diagram it, as I did last time, to diagram the emotional at that point happens to be the easier, because psychiatry has been dedicated really to helping us understand, and psychology, how the process begins and what happens in the analysis process. I think I can show that a little more tonight in answer to your question. I think it'll come up in answer to the body functions at its best when, which is both physical and mental. So we'll come to that. All right, let's just put that on the board as a basic statement that we're going to look at to start with. The body functions at its... Now, I want to give you two alternatives here. One is the body functions at its worst, over here. The body functions at its best, over here. And then to say, and I'm basing this pretty much on the studies of Hans Selye. Hans Selye was this physiologist who lived in Canada much of his life, who was from Austria, who died about 2 years ago, and he wrote the book, The Stress of Life. His big, thick document came out in the middle 50s, and then he condensed this into an ordinary, easily readable book on the stress of life. It's available in paperback. There are two other books that I have neglected to mention that are in the bookstore that I think you ought to at least look at while you're here, relating to the whole business of dealing with the life in all its complexities. The first is called The Caring Question by Don and Nancy Tubesing, T-U-B-E-S-I-N-G. It's a little paperback, very inexpensive. The Caring Question. I just used it at the church I belong to in LaGrange, Illinois, outside of Chicago, for a six-week evening discussion, and found it to be a very, very helpful little book. And if you're interested in a book that's good for adult discussion, it has a lot to say for how we care for ourselves and how we care for others. And how do you make the decision to care for yourself when you know you should be thinking about caring for others as well? The other book is by Scott Peck, and it's called The Road Less Traveled. And it's in the bookstore. It's also in paperback. And it's by a psychiatrist by the name of Scott Peck, who is really quite a phenomenon, I think, for psychiatry. He had a gradual movement, you could call it a conversion, but it wasn't a sudden thing, a gradual movement toward the Christian faith, and in 1980 he was baptized. And he's written this book in a way that just surprises all kinds of people, and I've now heard of two different very bright professors in colleges who had been kind of soured on religion, but who read this book by Scott Peck and were very impressed with it and moved back toward a new appreciation of the Christian faith. He has a section on grace that is really so unexpected from a psychiatrist. And he deals with psychiatry, I'd say, at its very best. And I think you'll like it very much. If you want to read about psychiatry at its worst, then read a book called The Shrinking of America. I thought it had something to do with geology or something, that America was shrinking. But it speaks about how many Americans go to shrinks and that they are shrinking America. Kind of interesting. But I think you'll like these two books very much. I ran out of anything but Kleenex here, so I have to use that. Hatzidim, I think, has inspired me more than anybody in the area of stress, simply because he is so open to new ways of looking at the causes of stress. And so, while I'm not doing this exactly as he would do it, let's come at it this way and say that he's really talking about attitudes in people's hearts and minds toward the world. The body functions at its worst when a person has certain attitudes. Now that seems like a kind of innocuous word, attitude. I mean, if a person has a certain attitude, you mean that's terribly important? Yeah, attitudes are just as important as anything could possibly be. And the other word, of course, has to do with outlook on life, which we've already discussed. A person's outlook on life, a person's attitude toward life, is so crucial to the way in which the body functions that it is just really remarkable how, when we deal with this kind of person who has a certain condition, we deal with them this way. When another person comes in who has the same kind of physical problem but has a different attitude on life, we have to deal with them in an entirely different way. So don't ever think that your attitude toward life is unimportant. It, to me, is really the most important thing there is for us. Okay, when your body is functioning at its worst, often then it's related to your attitude. Not always, of course. But let's say, what are some attitudes, and we'll just make a list of some attitudes that you would say are kind of malignant, make people sick, make you sick, are bad attitudes. Let's hear them. If you can think of any. What?
Jealousy.
Jealousy. All right.
Fear.
Fear.
Anger.
Anger.
Anxiety.
You're not having any trouble getting ideas.
Resentment.
Resentment.
Guilt.
Guilt. Depression. Coming just as fast as I can write.
Pessimism.
What?
Pessimism.
Pessimism.
Loss.
What?
Lonely loss.
I'm trying to get that one.
Loss.
L-O-S-S? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sense of loss. Loneliness.
Time pressure.
Time pressure.
Inadequacy.
What was that?
Inadequacy.
Inadequacy, a sense of inadequate. I'm just inadequate to the task.
Poor self-image.
What?
Poor self-image.
Poor self-image. low self-esteem. I think I want to get that in there too. It's the same thing, but I think that we're beginning to take that as a very important part of us. Well, you're doing pretty well. As you saw these words go down, did you feel something of what those words mean to you? The body just kind of automatically, when you talk about anger, anxiety, resentment, muscles begin to tighten up at the sound of the various types of words. Now, I've left room here for Dr. Selye's word that he uses to describe what he considers to be the body functioning at its worst. What word do you think he is using? He's in favor of all of these, I'm sure. But let's hear some more now.
Sense of futility.
What?
Futility.
Sense of futility.
Hate.
What?
Hate.
Hate? Okay, that's a good one, but it isn't one of his. It isn't his. It's getting close. You're getting warm.
Frustration.
Frustration. That's a good one, but that isn't his either.
Negativism.
That's good. Negative. I mean, that's bad. Negativism. You've forgotten some pretty bad ones, like self-centeredness, you know? Mm-hmm. We got jealousy here, but self-centeredness. What do you suppose his word is?
Selfish.
What?
Selfish.
Selfish? That's okay too, but we'll just put that in the list.
Egotism.
What?
Egotism.
Egotism, all right. Well, isn't it interesting that you can't think of his word? I'm real glad that you can't. Because that says that you just don't have that problem at all.
Is it anal me?
No. Starts with R. Resentment. You're pretty warm when you get resentment.
Rancor.
Revenge, I think I heard. That's his word. Revenge, which he says... He is a person who says, I'll get even with that SOB if it's the last thing I do. And sometimes it is the last thing I do. That's right. The number of people whom I've worked with heart attacks, with what they call an East Coast shock or stroke, and I've been meeting with a group of stroke victims, they know that many of them know this word. Revenge. And they know that this is the word, that this is the attitude that does them in. I'll get even with that person. I think it's kind of interesting, you see, that here's a man in a white coat who's a physiologist and an MD, who's one of the high priests of today's religion called science. And after years and years of study, he comes out by saying, you know what I think? I think that the body functions at its worst when a person has an attitude of, I'll get even with him. Well, that's what the Bible's been saying for a long, long time. And that's what the gospel is all about, that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is not the answer. And we keep thinking, is Israel never going to learn this lesson back over there in Lebanon and all those people? They're going to get even. If somebody does something to you, do something back. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, revenge. But I'm glad to know that here in scientific circles, they're now saying these are the things that make people sick. And we all have them, every one of us. Now, let's look on the other side and see the body functions at its best when you have certain other kinds of attitudes. What would they be? Well, look at all, that's wonderful. You just have so many good things. Let me hear one at a time.
Sense of humor.
Okay, all right, that's a good place to start. Humor.
Love.
Forgiveness.
Positive.
Security.
You say positive, let me just put the word hope in there too.
Supportive.
Supportive. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Being supported or supportive. Other people caring.
Optimism.
Optimism. That's the same as positive, if you don't mind.
Understanding.
Understanding, all right. Trying to be understanding of others and of oneself.
I'm surprised. Don't you know any more good words?
Exceptions.
You knew more bad words than you knew good words.
Joy.
Joy, all right.
Patience.
What?
Patience.
Patience, you bet.
Acceptance.
What?
Acceptance.
Acceptance, you bet. Of yourself and others.
Peace of mind.
Peace, inner peace, all right.
Kindness.
Yes? What was that?
Kindness.
Kindness,
all right. I'm sure that would be helpful. What's the opposite of a few of these?
Good self-concept.
Good self-concept.
Daring.
Confidence.
Confidence. An attitude of what else?
Daring.
Daring. Risking. Willing to. A person who's willing to risk some of his life for others.
Trusting.
Risking. Trusting.
Having faith.
Faith. Oh, I'm glad faith. Let's put up that pretty important up here. I was hoping that would come.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. I think we've got that. Yes.
Courage.
What?
Courage.
Kind.
Courage.
Courage. All right. Well, I've left space here for the one that Dr. Hans Selye thinks is a good word. And he feels it's the word that describes best how the body operates at its best. What do you think it is? No, I'm really a little surprised that a group of fine Christian people haven't come upon this word. It's in the Bible all over the place, and
mercy.
You deal with it. What?
Mercy.
Mercy, that's a good word. Yes.
Magnanimity.
Oh, that's a big one. All right.
Justice.
What?
The body's rested.
Resting.
Rested.
Well rested.
Rested.
How do you spell that?
R-E-S-T-E-D.
Yeah, well, rested. Okay. Yeah. Well rested. No? I haven't got room for many more now.
What letter does it start with?
Well, we even have a day of the year devoted to this word.
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving. Shame on you. How come you never thought of that? But the word that he uses is gratitude, an attitude of gratitude. And believe me, I am convinced that that is one of the most important words there is. Oh, give thanks, since Uncle Normie, to the Lord, for he is good, his mercy endureth forever. Oh, give thanks. Oh, give thanks. It's all over the place. And the strange thing is that you in this group are no different than any other Christian group I talk to. They don't seem to know the word gratitude. And I think that's one of the saddest things I know, if it means that we have become so accustomed to these other nice words that we've forgotten all about from whom all blessings flow, and that we are not expressing this kind of gratitude. We're in bad trouble. So I think you'll never forget this word because it rhymes with attitude. An attitude of gratitude. Yes?
I wonder if that is perhaps the reason for that could be that on the other words, we have more of a sense of being the initiator.
Ah.
But in gratitude, you have this sense of responding.
That's right.
Something that's initiated by someone else.
I would think that would have a lot to do with it.
But
which says that
doesn't revenge have the same
revenge?
Have the same polarity?
No. Revenge starts with us. I get even with him.
but it always involves someone else.
Yes. Yes, maybe so. All right. But isn't it wonderful to know that you've been hearing this from the pulpit ever since you were a little tyke. And now the men of science, who are the priests of this religion called science, have, after years of study, come to the conclusion, you know what we think? We think that the body functions at its best when a person has an attitude of gratitude. I'm just grateful to God for life and for all that it means to me. Tomorrow, try to think of that during the day. Think of the many times during the day that you could, if you haven't already done it, that you could take time to just express a word of gratitude and see what it does for your body. I'd say it's one of the most helpful chemicals. Norman Cousins, you know, frequently says that the body, the mind, is like a big, huge pharmaceutical house or drugstore. And it has all the ingredients necessary for any of the fancy concoctions that druggists are able to put together. And that if you call upon it in the right way, and I thought you were going to get at it sooner because you started with humor. And his idea was that humor, which is certainly related to gratitude, you just, oh, you're so grateful for this, you enjoy it, your body just responds, you feel good. And as you know, that was how he feels he cured himself, through an attitude of gratitude and humor. And he says that the mind just sends forth into the body the various kinds of drugs that are needed at that particular moment. And I'll bet you someday we're going to see that. Because when you deal with the placebo effect, we used to think the placebo is when you give somebody an empty pill, or water pill, or whatever you'd want to call it. There is nothing in it that has medicinal value. And yet, all the studies show that placebos are very, very effective in many, many cases. And what we used to say is, well, it was just all in your mind. Don't put it quite like that. It's to some extent in the mind, because the mind can make a difference, which has to do with your attitude. It's all in your attitude, you might say. So that when the doctor says, I am giving you a shot, and you assume that it has medication in it, and it does not, and you get the proper response, what happened? Well, it was that your mind sent the proper medication to that part of the body that needed the care. And don't ever apologize for that kind of response. Just be grateful that the body is so made that it can respond magnificently to help. I was reading only in the last couple days since I talked to you, I think I said earlier in the week, that medical students, and this is true, that medical students for a long, long time have been told early in the week, their first week of school usually, that 65% of patients who are ill will get well by themselves. That is, the body is its own doctor. Albert Schweitzer said that every person has a doctor inside himself. 65%. But this week I was reading that is now being moved up to close to 75 to 80%. That some scholars in this field are saying that the body is able to cure itself up to 75 to 80% of the problems that occur in the body are cured by the body. That's a high percentage. Now, the ticklish part is, how do you tell whether you have the kind of illness that can be cured by your doctor within you or needs the doctor without you, I mean outside you? And that's one of the reasons we have doctors, to make that differentiation, as they call it, a differential diagnosis. Okay, any reflections, any more reflections on this? Yes?
You might be considered a Pollyanna sometimes in our society, I think, if you're too full of gratitude.
That's right. And Pollyannas are laughed at. But don't let them put you down, because there is real value let's not say it's Pollyannas. Let's say that you are very much aware that what you're going through is a hellish situation. and you just would like to just throw in the sponge and get rid of the whole thing. But you say, as a realist, I know that I can get terribly upset with this, and I can just let it get overwhelm me, and I can go down the tube with it. But I happen to know that the body responds to gratitude, and so, darn it, I'm going to look for something for which I can be grateful. And I know you're going to think I'm Pollyannish about this, but I'm still going to do it. Now, if you do it in that context, that you are an adult, you have a mature way of looking at life, you know that the other is probably the way you ought to sound and you ought to be, but you're not going to do that. I think as long as you are in control and make the decision, I'm just not going to let myself go down the tube because I feel that I want to, because I'm going to show that I can handle it. And I'm going to change the subject right now, and I'm going to get on something different, and I'm going to force myself into humor and an attitude of gratitude. I think it's perfectly permissible. I've been working at it for a long time.
Table prayer.
What?
A table prayer is an opportunity to express gratitude.
Yeah. Do you remember the story of one of our actors that used to, Lionel Barrymore, before he was in the wheelchair that some of the movies show him in, which he had to stay in the rest of his life. But I remember the movie You Can't Take It With You. And he had a large family. They'd gather around the table, and they'd all stand up, and he would be at the end of the table, and he'd look up and he'd say, Well, Lord, here we are again. And they'd all sit down in a hurry and dig in like any family would. And in the theater, the movie theater, everybody laughed, of course. A few minutes later, a little while later in the movie, they come back to the table, another meal, and he stands there and he says, Well, Lord, here we are again. And they dig in. Not so much laughter that time. It happened a third time in the movie. Well, Lord, here we are again. And I have thought of that over and over again. Yeah, that's what we do. We come to this table again and again and again, for which we're constantly grateful. And you and I have done pretty well today upstairs there at the table. And I've thought of that as a prayer, and I've used it frequently in my own home. Well, Lord, here we are again, which means, and boy, are we grateful to you. And I think that is the spirit that we need to have to recognize the goodness of God to us. Any other reflections or comments? Yes?
It seems to me we live in a society where we take too many things for granted. And gratitude, like other virtues, takes a certain amount of training or practice. And I remember, as I suppose many of us do, our mother saying to us, thank the uncle, or, you know, say thanks. And I hear the comments of more and more that people aren't saying thanks for little things or ordinary things. They take them for granted. So I wonder whether we need not to develop just practice gratitude by being thankful for these very little things that happen in everyday life, even gifts from other people. In our church, for example, we've given many things away. It's surprising how often. Usually no one says thank you. And even for sometimes substantial scholarships and gifts, and you say, well, that's what the church is supposed to do. I just wonder whether as a society we're not as grateful as we might be for the things that happen in everyday life, and we need a little bit more practice in that. So maybe mothers and fathers and the rest of us ought to say thank the uncle and say thank you.
So it's something that really needs to be worked at. I guess I think that's about where we are in our society. We are, you know, we're the most overloaded society in the world with unnecessary things that we don't absolutely have to have. And we develop this feeling of, I deserve this. Sure, why not? Yes?
One of my favorite books in the Bible has always been the Psalms. And I think for that very reason.
Yes.
The Psalms were the worship book of Israel, and they're just filled with statements of praise, of gratitude, and sometimes think that the Psalms is trying to find every possible way you can to say thank you.
trying to.
Of course, there's some imprecatory in other films which go in the other direction.
Yeah, he also says it. He's also pretty honest about a lot of things. But there's more gratitude in the book than perhaps in any other book in the Bible. I remember when I first came upon this book, or this Dress of Life, back in the 50s, I was having some difficulties with my vocation as to whether was I in the right place and so on. And I'd wake up about 2 o'clock in the morning and just had great difficulty getting back to sleep. Stewing, worrying. I haven't got the word worry in here, but that's better than in here. Worry. And I found myself saying, well, now I'm supposed to be grateful, and Dr. Celia says you should be grateful, and that the body will function better if I'm grateful. So I'll try. Well, lying there in bed in the middle of the night, tossing, what was there to be grateful for? So I began saying, well, I guess I'm grateful for this bed. I've got a nice bed, and I'm grateful for the clean sheets. And I'm grateful for the pillow. And I'm grateful for the little radio that I've got here that I can turn on. And I'm grateful that I have an extra room so I can move away from my wife at night when I snore and bother her, and I can get my sleep. Well, I found myself making a long list night after night. And eventually, instead of counting sheep, I was counting my blessings. Now here you go, back to the old idea. Count your blessings. Count your blessings one by one, or whatever it is. It sounds kind of silly and Pollyanna-ish, but I can just assure you from my many years of experience that gratitude is really the best medicine I know for you and me. Any other comments? Yes?
I had an experience where we moved, and for 8 months we had to live in a 23-foot self-contained trailer. And I was very grateful to have my bath at that, the washer dryer. And even now at times when I get down and I'll be at home, I can still reflect on the memories of being closed up in something that wasn't hard to being able to turn around in.
Yeah.
And I sometimes have thought some of my friends who complain about little things being good, I thought, you know, the best thing for you to do would be to force yourself to scale down so that you can come back up again.
Right.
And a lot of friends, 2 or 3 friends in our neighborhood had done the same thing because they were in the process of building a home, and the only reasonable financial thing was to hole up in a little trailer while they were building. And it puts a whole different light on their new home than they finally moved in. It
really does. Yes?
I think, too, sometimes a counter to this whole idea of gratitude is this whole self-help movement, and we're so hung up on doing everything ourselves. A thank you indicates that somebody else is there helping us too.
That's right.
And so, you know, we don't want to acknowledge that there's other people that are helping us.
The little book, The Caring Question, deals with that, I think, very well. You'll find that to be true. That it's saying that this whole self-help mood of the day is kind of a fad, and that the self-help becomes so important that we take care of self, that we really go to the other extreme then, and I mean, we find ourselves so interested in ourselves we have no time for others. And the question is, how do you balance it? We should take care of ourselves, but we also should take care of others. And self, taking care of one's body, I think of some people that are, you know, I know them well, who are now in the jogging phase and who come home and have to always have an hour of jogging at great length all over the place, and their wives have to wait with the dinner until 8 o'clock now instead of the usual 6 o'clock hour, and their whole lives are centered around jogging. And as I see it, to these two people that I know, that's their religion now. Their God is their body. And jogging is the way they keep their body in shape, of course. And so here we are with a wonderful idea in exercise being carried to extremes so that it becomes an interest in oneself to the exclusion of the God who has given us this, so that we've got to have the other side of it balancing. Yes, Rick, Dick.
He's not the tension, however, with the fact that often much of life is lived in the pits. there are times when grief is necessary. And to develop an attitude of gratitude too soon after a grief process is not healthy. And so there is another side to the coin, I think, which perhaps maybe you wish to deal with, that sometimes some of these, maybe not all the words on the list, but there is a time when the grief and working through the grief process can be and have to occur in order for help to continue and to be a part of the human
exactly. In my little book called Good Grief, which we may have some copies of tomorrow, they sold them out last week, and I was supposed to tell you about this, and I'm glad I just remembered it. There are a couple words on this side that I'm saying are very, very much a part of grieving, and that you have to deal with these words, and one of them is anger, so that even when I wrote it on the board, I almost wanted to put a question mark here, because there are times when I see that anger is a very good thing. In fact, it helps me to see a person who is going through grief, when they finally get to the anger stage and can tell me how angry they are with God, then I feel I'm dealing with somebody that's coming alive. Whereas if they're completely passive and completely depressed and are not able to express their anger about what has happened, I know that I haven't got them on the up curve yet. We're still in the down curve. So anger is good. And even the Bible says, let not the sun go down upon your wrath, which means it's okay to be angry until about 5:30 or 6 o'clock. And then the next day you can get angry again. Just get a good night's sleep, that's all.
What the barking dog keeps you.
Yes. The other word that's on my list there is anxiety. Anxiety, or panic at times, but anxiety is a better word, and in German I think it's called Angst. Most anybody who's ever amounted to anything in this world got started amounting to anything in this world because he went through the depths of despair at one point and was so filled with anxiety that he finally had to come clean with himself and his relationship to his Creator or to whatever it was, if he's not that disposed to say the word Creator. Anxiety is the point at which a person comes face to face with himself, and it can be a very good emotion. So I thank you, Dick, for reminding me, and maybe there are some others here. Oh, another word on the list is guilt. I have 10 words on the list. First is shock, the second is emotional release, the third is depression, the fourth is physical symptoms, the fifth is panic or anxiety. The sixth is anger. The seventh is guilt. The eighth is resistance to change. The ninth is hope comes through gradually. And tenth is that we can reaffirm reality. So, that's right. And it all is related to loss, which I say your grief can become good grief if you deal with it realistically. And here reminds me of your question again about Pollyanna. The last thing you'd ever hear from me is that you should hide this and say, I'm not angry, I'm not anxious, I'm not guilty, and so on. We're saying, oh no, these are real emotions. Deal with them. Express them as you have to. And your body's going to feel torn apart, sure. But you're going through the grief experience, and you've got to be open and honest about it. And the more you can talk about this within reason, the more your body will finally begin to help you to deal with the real issue, and then you can move through it. But you move through it, and then you eventually get to gratitude. If somebody in deep grief says, oh, I'm just so grateful for everything and my loss of, you know, I've just got to be grateful to the Lord for having given me this wonderful gift, and I've lost it, but I'm grateful to the Lord. I say, oh, come on, get off it. I know how you really feel. Now tell me how you really feel. And then you hear an entirely different story. They are not ready for gratitude yet. And I would be the first to say, come off it. You're not being your real self. So please don't see me as saying, always be grateful. No matter what the heck happens to you, just say, thank you, Lord, That was wonderful. I'm glad you hit me over the head with that. Yeah, I'm not saying that. Ruth?
Not too long ago, I saw the result of something similar. Sorry, I can't cite it, but about the major cause of illness in America being related to disappointment. Disappointment was a word that was selected as being such a key problem for Americans in the 1980s. I'm wondering if you could address that.
The book called The Broken Heart, I thought you were going to be quoting that, says that the word that it would use more than any is the word loneliness. And the disappointment would, I think, be related to loneliness in the sense that we're disappointed, we have nothing that we can make out of life, no matter what we do, we are disappointed with it. But the word loneliness is a big word in America, and that's why I am so hopeful that the local congregation will begin to realize that loneliness is a major illness in our culture. And even though we have all these people around us, there's an awful lot of loneliness. And that's why I hope that each congregation will begin to assess its worth in the health field and in the wellness field. You see, what we are planning to do, what we are doing already with this nurse on the church staff who becomes a minister of health, is that she gradually will begin to put together a list of all the people in the congregation, and she will get to know them all. Some of them are suggesting we have a picture for each one so that the nurse will know all the people in the congregation. One of the first lists sub-lists she wants to make, and eventually this might go on a computer, I don't know, are the people who would be considered the lonely people, the people who go to church on a Sunday and they have no other friends, they go back to an apartment and they're there all alone all week or whatever it may be. Particularly, of course, this is with elderly. And that our job, let's say you have a church of 500 people, my guess is that in that church you would have at least 25 very lonely people, for whom the church has made no real plans in many cases. It has done it on a happenstance basis. See, I feel that our job now for the next few years is to recognize that the parish church has all kinds of potential for helping to keep people well, and that it can bring lonely people out of their loneliness and their sickness into a sense of wellness. Now, churches are doing all kinds of good things for people, and I am in no way saying that the church isn't doing anything. Not at all. I just think that the church isn't organized to do that job as well as it could do it if it had somebody whose sole job in that congregation was to see how to keep people well. One day I was sitting with a group of pastors, and they all had active congregations, and I said, I really think you guys are in the health business and you don't know it. Let me just put a list down of things that your church is now engaging in that I would say are helpful to keeping people well. And so we made a list, and I'm going to read this to you. It takes about 3 minutes. But just to kind of remind you, not every church is doing all these things, but many congregations are involved in several of the following ministries which help keep people well. And the first one I would put would be the fellowship hours in the church, coffee hours, whatever you want to call them, after Sunday worship and after various meetings, and in connection with many weekday meetings. Friendships develop, and friendships of the right kind tend to keep people well. Now, have we seen friendships in the category of being wellness of opportunities? I think we've kind of not seen that. And this is what we're saying to medical students. Be sure to find out from your patient what kind of friends this person has. What's a typical week life in their life? And see how they're spending it. Then, of course, we have youth group events, many with health-giving components, with sports and baseball and all kinds of things. Overnight retreats for adults of all ages, held in places away from the usual stresses of living. Then simple things like blood pressure checks by volunteer nurses in the churches. And that usually leads to a discussion with a nurse. I've seen so many people come up for blood pressure checks and then say to the nurse, if nobody's around, could I talk to you sometime? And that's what we like to see happen. And that's what's developing in our churches, that are having nurses as members of the staff. Blood drives and health fairs. Healthcare themes on certain Sundays of the church year. Informal social services available through volunteers. And formal services, social services available through church-related social agencies. Frequent special offerings to assist people in times of need. Many pastors have a contingency fund that they can go to help people. Benevolence budgets constituting 20 to 50% of total church budget. Part of this goes for medical missions and social causes. Food pantries. And maybe your church now has a food pantry and it hadn't had one for years and years since the Great Depression. Why do we call it a Great Depression? The worst depression. Meals on Wheels for the homebound. I think this is one of the great things. How many of your churches have Meals on Wheels? Quite a few. And now they're spending more time delivering this, so they give people only two deliveries or three to make, and then they say, feel free to stop at the last one. Choose the one you want to stop with and just spend an extra half hour with that person. Sewing groups making medical supplies. Intergenerational programs of all types. Youth projects relating to the elderly in the community. Involvement with hospice programs. How many of you know of hospice programs in your communities? This has happened, you know, only in the last, 8 years, something like that. Volunteers available for every conceivable kind of emergency, often through an organized group called FISH. Any of you connect with FISH? No FISH groups here? One or two? Okay, but they have done some great work. Sermons and feedback discussions where people learn to articulate their faith questions and their insights. So if we're talking about outlook on life, then the discussion groups and the sermon feedback groups give you a chance to articulate your faith, to understand your faith better, which automatically causes your body to feel better because you have a faith component now that is as good as any medicine that you could ever take. Daycare centers for working mothers and fathers. Well, the daycare is for the children, obviously. Emergency telephone networks among members in some churches. Prayer telephone networks. Educational courses in Sunday school and confirmation classes related to health and prevention. Potluck neighborhood support groups building friendships again. Ongoing Bible study groups, which are also human support groups. This one on Potluck Neighborhood Group, I think of a group in our church. Every time we have a new bunch of members, they are asked to put on the fall frolic, or whatever they call it. And so you have maybe 25 people, or maybe 25 to 30, 35 people, who for the first time are asked to do something for that congregation, in the way of a whole evening of fun and dinner and program and all that goes with it. I am really surprised at the number of these groups that stay together. Some of them have stayed together for 25 years. As a result of this, they continue with their potluck groups. One of the healthiest things you could ever do for a group of people. Volunteer drivers to take elderly and ill to the doctors, to hospitals, to shopping. Volunteers who assist with domestic chores for the sick. Many churches also provide space and leadership for no smoking clinics, Alcoholics Anonymous and all the related groups, parenting groups, stress management workshops, nutrition seminars, marriage support groups, visiting nurse groups, well baby clinics, compassionate friends, mental health groups, exercise classes, birthing classes, premarital conferences, health fairs. Do you know of any other institution in America that does more for health than the churches already? Now let's begin to organize that, and I think we will be amazed at what we'll be able to do to show that we are keeping people from having to go to hospitals. I would say that churches should spend much less time building new hospitals and much more time keeping people out of hospitals, and that's the future. So the final statement here is that every church has the potential of becoming a wellness clinic. If churches will eventually have well-qualified nurses on their staffs to coordinate and encourage more intentional development of this health aspect of the church's life, then many illnesses could be picked up in their early stages when they are often reversible. The churches of America hold great promise in motivating people to see that whole person health care must include the spiritual dimension. Tomorrow, what I'm going to try to talk about, and I'm leaving tomorrow noon, so I'm going to meet with whatever group wants to come tomorrow at 10:45. And I'm going to talk about taking a spiritual history, which is related to the idea that doctors have said to me, you know, we take a physical history. Do you guys, ministers, take a spiritual history? And our answer is, well, we don't exactly take a spiritual history. We get to know the person, and eventually we would be able to give you a spiritual history of this person. Why don't you come out right front, the doctors say, and just plain ask them some of these questions. Maybe you'd get off to a faster start. So tomorrow I'll be describing how we've been experimenting with some faster start kinds of questions, and how some have been successful and some have been very unsuccessful. Well, we've got two more minutes. What other questions?
I'd like to ask,
yes?
This is shifting gears a little bit, but for the past couple of years I've worked in a residential treatment center for emotionally disturbed kids. And every day I'd go to work, I'd see these, you know, bruised little people that, you know, it just got to be too much for me to look at. And eventually I'd quit my job because I just couldn't take it anymore. I was having migraine headaches like at least once every 3 weeks and stuff, you know. I agree that you need to have an attitude of gratitude, but what can you do when you're in the negative cycle to break out of that? I tried all kinds of things.
I think that there are some people who can take it and other people that can't. I finally found that there were certain kinds of patients that I was just, as a chaplain, I was a chaplain way back, that I just couldn't handle because it just tore me apart inside. And I think you just have to recognize your own limitations. And all people can't do all kinds of things. I see some women that have worked in hospices now for 8 years or so, and I say, how can you do it? And they say, well, I don't know. I guess I just am built to feel comfortable doing it. Others working in nursing homes, dealing with terribly sick people in awful conditions. And I say, how can you do it? And some of them say, well, I'm going to have to give it up. I can't take it anymore. I've been at it for 3 years or 5 years. And others say, I've been at it for 15 years and I love it. I can hardly wait to get to work every day. And here I am in this place feeling so uncomfortable that I can hardly wait till I leave. I just think you cannot push yourself beyond your own personal limitations. Thank you. See you tomorrow.